the J-Talk Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the J-Talk Podcast. Ben Maxwell and Sam Robson with you. And Sam, the match day 31 fixtures were definitely pivotal at both ends of the table.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, certainly at the top. I'm not quite sure it's cleared of anything, particularly at the bottom. But yeah, we can almost crown champions. I bet Robson, if that was a betting company, we'd have paid out on an F. Marinos victory. Yeah, so premature congratulations to them.
Yeah, it looks all but done and dusted. Just a few I's to dot and T's to cross before we can, celebrate with F. Marinos, their players and supporters. Somebody is joining us this week in not such a celebratory mood, perhaps after a frustrating home draw for his Gumbo Osaka side on Saturday afternoon. But it's always great to welcome Johnny Nicol back to the podcast. And Johnny, hopefully this can be a bit cathartic for you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good, Ben. And I think this might be the first time I've been on and Gamba have drawn and haven't lost this season. So I guess that's one step up. And then, congratulations, premature congratulations to Marinos too. And Gamba will hope to be party poopers this weekend. But I'm looking forward to talking about their game, our game, and all the games with you and Sam tonight.
Terrific stuff. All right, then. So let's jump into it then. Match day 31. All eight games were played on Saturday. Unfortunately, we lost the Shimizu versus Iwata game that we were so much looking forward to, of course. But the Shizuoka Derby was postponed after the ongoing effects of Typhoon number 15 meant that the J-League felt that it was unsafe for the game to go ahead. So that was has already been rescheduled for Saturday, October the 22nd, which is Levain Cup final day. So let's crack on then at the top of the table, but not with champions-elect Yokohama F. Marinos, because there is no other place we can start, Sam, than Atsubetsu up in Hokkaido, where Sapporo hosted Kawasaki Frontale. The two-time defending champions simply had to win to keep their hopes of a third straight J1 title alive. And in a ding-dong battle, a seesawing affair, and to many it'll be the game of the season so far. Unfortunately for Frontale and all fans of the J1 title race, they did not get it done.
No, they didn't. And unfortunately, the previous result for Sapporo was 0-0, because it was never going to be that 2 weeks in a row. And this was anything but that. It was an incredible game. I thought Sapporo played really well. They were really attacking. I thought Gabriel Xavier had one of his best games in a Sapporo shirt. I think he controlled things. He was involved. He scored disallowed goals. He set up, I think, the penalty. He scored another fine header. He was just involved in absolutely everything. And Kawasaki didn't really deal with Sapporo's attacking threat. I mean, we've said it most of the season, the lack of depth in this Frontale squad, if you compare it to Yokohama. I think that got exposed, especially in the first half. Yamane and Taniguchi didn't play because they've been off on international duty. Left holes in that back line, which were taken apart, really, by Sapporo. I think they showed good courage in the second half, Kawasaki, and they came back and got themselves back into the lead in that game. But then, just couldn't cope with their Sapporo the other way. It turned into an absolute end-to-end fantastic game of football. But, it was just a bridge too far for Kawasaki. And, that's it for them. But I think a lot of credit has to go to the way Sapporo approached the game.
Yeah, most definitely. So, Johnny, Sam just mentioned there, Gabriel Xavier's tour de force. The official records will show he only scored one legal goal in this game, but you had the ball in the net a total of three times, and he played a major role in the entertainment factor of this game. Definitely one of his best games, I think, in a Sapporo shirt.
Yeah, I think we've got a couple of questions we'll get onto later about, like, surprises this season. And yeah, I think Gabriel Xavier, I wasn't really sure what to expect from him, because he obviously had a big reputation from built on like three or four seasons ago at Nagoya. And you're never really sure, because he'd been out the frame there for so long, how would he get back into the swing of playing regularly? And it's definitely been a struggle for him and also for Sapporo, Ogashiwa and Kuroki both scored in this game. They've had spells out, and they've really struggled with Lachanitip leaving and Jay leaving as well. And I think coming back to the element of surprise, as you mentioned, this game was played at Atsubetsu, which usually hinders Sapporo whenever I see them play there, because it's quite bumpy and the weather can be a bit windy. It really doesn't suit that sort of fast-paced style of football that they like to play in the Sapporo Dome. But I've watched the highlights of this, I think, twice in DAZN and once on YouTube, and I'm still trying to count how many times did Xavi have the ball in the net, how many times was the post hit, you know, everything was going on. And as Sam said, I think you guys called it right when you were talking about the Sapporo Marinos game, like, there's no way there's going to be two 0-0 Sapporo games in a row, and they definitely delivered it, as did Gabriel Xavier on this occasion.
Yeah, so much action, end-to-end battles in this game. It was, phenomenal to watch and, breathless at times. Frontale did lead twice in this game, first through Akihiro Iyanaga's penalty on the half hour after Kento Tachibanada was bundled over in the box by Daihachi Okamura. Their first lead lasted only 3 minutes, though. Lucas Fernandez, who was also heavily involved, he pounced on a loose ball and drove home for 1-1. Then came the first of Xavier's disallowed goals, and probably the best goal of the entire game. Unfortunately, that it didn't count, a shot from 25 yards 8 minutes before half time. But then shortly before the break, Sapporo went in front from the spot themselves, Shinzo Kuroki scoring after a ridiculous challenge by Asahi Sasaki on Fernandez. And Kuroki's goal was a milestone one for him. He broke a tie with Hisato Sato. That was Kuroki's 162nd top flight goal, making him J1's second all-time top scorer. So congratulations to him. And not sure if he's going to be able to catch Yoshito Okubo. He's 29 goals behind him. But Kuroki, second all-time now in the top flight. So Frontale found themselves at 2-1 down. But then the two goals in 10 minutes, just past the hour from Frontale, saw them go 3-2 up. First, Kei Chinen scored after an almighty scrap on the Sapporo goal line. The goal was finally awarded by VAR after it was determined that the ball had crossed the line. And then a brilliant Yu Kobayashi finish from the edge of the box in the 69th minute put the champions back on top. But Sapporo weren't finished there. And, the remainder of the last 20 minutes of the 90, and then I guess the full 12 minutes of added time, Sam, they could be an hour-long Patreon-exclusive episode in its own right. But so much still to happen in this game. And, as I said, it was breathless at times. And unfortunately for Frontale, they weren't able to hang on. This is just what we've come to expect, I suppose, from Sapporo, isn't it? They just, they only know one way to play. And, unfortunately, Frontale weren't able to blunt them.
No, they absolutely weren't. And I mean, there's no setting in Mischa Petrovic that says, let's settle for what we have or anything like that. They're not going to sit back. Once they got it back to 3-3, it was like a couple of minutes, wasn't it? The goal from Xavier, and then Xavier sent in a through ball. Tachibanada pulls him down. No, Xavier was sent through, sorry. Tachibanada pulls him down. Red card, initially a penalty that was overturned. But those 2 minutes, that took the game away from Frontale. It was always going to be Sapporo from then on with the man advantage. They had loads of added time because of an injury to Jung Sung Ryung, and eventually they made that pressure pay. They almost, Xavier got a tap in almost to win it. That was obviously disallowed. I think it was an offside from Kim Kun Hee in the build up to that, and then they finally got the winner right in the end. Ogashiwa, who has just not played enough football this season for Sapporo. He is a quality player when he's fit, and he eats a lovely little touch away and then finds the bottom corner past Jung. Terrific finish and incredible ending to the game, and an incredible ending really to the title race.
Yeah, remarkable stuff. So, Johnny, obviously we're going to segue on to Yokohama F. Marinos. And, as we've all said, the team now almost certain to win the title. So, I don't know, a bit of a tough question without notice here. But when Toru Uniki looks back at this season, maybe the second half of this season, once the dust has settled and, the shield has been raised on the other side of Kanagawa, and, Frontale reflect on how they're going to go and win it back. Where do you think Oniki will identify where it's gone wrong for his side, and how will he go about to trying to fix it in 2023, do you think?
It's interesting to note, because I've got the league table here, and Frontale have lost eight games this season, and I just quickly looked in the Meikan. They'd only lost two last year, so I think they've been too easy to play against. You know, the previous years they had those like Morita, Hatate, Mitoma, all those great names. They just dominated from start to finish, and obviously with the kind of global exposure the J-League's had in recent seasons, it's impossible to keep those players for too long. So I think what's happened to Frontale is what would happen to any team. Like, you know, if Mariners go on and win two or three titles, and you'll see them, like, you know, the players like Nishimura, Iwata, Fujita, Watanabe, they'll all go to Europe. And then I think that's why we love the J League so much. No team is ever really able to build up a dynasty. Like, teams have done it over 3 or 4 years, like Kashima in the past, or like what Kawasaki are doing now. So I think, yeah, I'm sure Oniki is an extremely passionate and driven man, and he will not be happy to give up the title, especially not to the noisy neighbours, Marinos. I think Frontale don't really change the squad much from season to season, but I think in attack, we're probably going to have to see a big changes, because there's rumours, I think Marcinho is going to go to Egypt. I don't know how much truth is in them, but I seem to see them every day. And that there's been the annual Ienaga to Gamba rumour, which I'm not paying much heed to. But Ienaga is getting on a bit, despite his fine form this year. And then you look at centre-forward, Kei Chinin is their highest-scoring centre-forward. So, I mean, Damian and Kobayashi are not getting any younger. So I think there's a couple of players they've got coming in. I think there's a young guy from Toei and Yokohama University, Yamada, and then Miyashiro. But neither of them really have that kind of star quality. They'd be looking for a big name up front. I think, yeah, they've just not enough depth, not enough of the experienced players, especially up front, have really put their hand up. And yeah, they've found themselves only 1-0 up or drawing games that they previously have put to bed in seasons gone by. So I think, you know, from a supporting a team that's in 17th, I'd be quite jealous of finishing second, not too far behind first place. But Oniki will not be satisfied. The Frontale fans won't be satisfied. I'd expect to see some pretty big changes. And Sam, would you go along with that? And where do you think they've kind of gone wrong as opposed to previous years?
Yeah, I think definitely need changes. I think in the end, it's the recruitment at the start of the season that has really hurt them. Obviously, they went into the season without Jessiel. They knew that. He wasn't going to play until, July in the end. And they went in with one other centre-back in Taniguchi. They didn't bother to get any sort of replacements. You're always putting square pegs into round holes to fill that. I think that contributes to some of their defeats. Up front, they've missed Damian for the last 6 weeks. Chinen is the replacement at the moment. He's okay, but not the right level to win a title, I don't think. And they gambled, really, with all the money went into Chanatip. And he's just been one injury after another this season. He's never really got going. They didn't really know how to fit him in at the start of the season. So I just think all of that didn't work. And it's not like they've, like previously, they've not made many signings, but they've had a Hatate and Mitoma come through out of university. And that's been incredible sort of signings for them. They didn't really have that this year. Nobody from the younger players has come in and really taken on the mantle at all. So I think they really need to address that. They've got areas in this squad that really need weakening. And as Marinos have done this season, they've had two teams that they can play and have come in and done really well. So I think that's the main difference between the two sides. And then in this last month, they've let games go where they should have won or were winning. Nagoya, they were ahead. They drew that game. I think it was the same against Kashua. Then that lost to Shonan. So they had games where they were winning, and then they should have gone on and taken this title race down to the wire. But there's that fragility in this team, which I think comes with more of a lack of confidence than necessarily a lack of ability. And I think that's really hurt them as well in this stretch. But yeah, anything else you'd like to add, Ben?
Well, yeah, I just think we wondered when the point of time would come where the number of players that they'd lost would come back to bite them. And yeah, I think we've found out that they've just lost one or two players too many. And unfortunately for their supporters who were hoping their side could join Antlers as the only teams ever in J1 history to win three straight J1 titles. Yeah, for the second time, it hasn't happened for them. And it's almost certain, as we said, that for the second time, it'll be F. Marinos spoiling the party. And yeah, they're obviously one of the most intriguing teams that we'll be keeping an eye on in the off season, because they're obviously a really attractive destination for players who might want to switch clubs or might want to come and play in Japan. And it's a matter of Oniki and his staff, or the sporting director, finding the right players, and then Oniki betting them in and getting the best out of them, because as we saw with the Chanatip, it just didn't quite click and hasn't quite clicked all season for numerous reasons. So Well, they've played their part in arguably the game of the season on Saturday, Frontale. But yes, unfortunately, it did not go their way. Kudos to Sapporo. And so just before we move off the game and move off them, Johnny, I mean, you said you've watched the highlights numerous times, so you might want to give Sapporo a bit more due. I don't know, but they're such a frustrating but lovable team to watch, aren't they? But on a day like Saturday, I mean, they can look irresistible at times, and it's just a matter of whether they stick with Miša Petrović and let him stay at the controls, or whether they want more of a steady hand down the line. But yeah, when they show what they're capable of in a game like Saturday, then they're certainly one of the most entertaining teams in the league to watch.
Yeah, absolutely. I know there's been a bit of debate among the sort of Sapporo fans, and obviously a famous former player as well, about Petrovic's future, and those in the kind of Petrovic out camp will maybe perhaps not be too happy to see they've got 10 points from the last four games, and they're not mathematically safe. But I don't see Fukuoka or Gamba or Iwata catching them. I think they only need one more win, and they probably don't really need any more wins. So I must say, you know, they're relevant, and you look teams below them, you've got Kobe, you've got Espals, you've got Gamba, probably even Jubilor, more resources than Sapporo. And then if you look ahead of them, I'd say Tosu are the only team that Sapporo would realistically think we should be finishing above them most seasons in terms of resources. So I definitely don't subscribe to the we finished fourth once, so we should be doing it more often. I think that sort of 9th, 10th, 11th, with the current level of investment and maybe location and playing squad that largely relies on kind of bringing in players from universities and also developing them in your youth team, I think they can look to the future with a bit of confidence. I think Goo Sung-young, the former South Korean goalkeeper, I believe is coming back next year. I don't think it's 100% sure, but I think, yeah, you mentioned Kim Gun-hee. Whenever I've seen him, he's looked pretty decent. I don't know why they didn't bring him on against Mariners. It was crying out for him, 0-0, and they left him on the bench. And then I think he wasn't involved here, but Super Chops came in with a few assists. So I'm interested to see how they do. They've got a young guy from Juntendo University coming in as well, Shingo Omori, who's a centre forward, I believe. So I tend to think Petrovic will stay. And it'll be more of the same formation, same crazy football. And, you know, attackers bedded in, new attackers coming in. I think Sugino's done a very good job deputising for Gu, but he'll be back. So, yeah, I mean, if you're a Sapporo fan, you would enjoy the game, and you might kind of go into the window, or the winter window, slightly optimistic. Would you go along with that, Sam? Or?
It's always an interesting one, isn't it, Sapporo? Because I never want to see the back of Miša Petrović, just as a complete neutral. Because, yeah, they're fantastic to watch. But I can understand frustration from Sapporo supporters. Obviously, yes, that fourth is an anomaly, but it shows that they could do it. And I think they've got really good players in this squad. It's not like it's a poor squad that's fighting above the level of the players in this squad. I think they've got really good players. Kanako, Akito Fukumori has just gone out. He's going to have to get a move, I think. I don't get caught up on him. But yeah, they've got so many good players that they should be fighting. I don't think this squad should be in a relegation battle. And I think Petrovic's tactics, although great to watch as a neutral, do allow them to lose games that they shouldn't be losing and gets them into trouble. So I can understand the frustration on that side. I would always keep him because it's just great fun. But yeah, I think he has to be. I really do think he needs to be reined in slightly. I just think if there was a little bit of a focus on defence at Sapporo, I think they could easily be a consistent top half team in this league. And I think that would be the next step really for Sapporo. I don't think they should be expecting challenging for the ACL every season, but I think that's a logical progression for them to be an established top half team. And I don't think they're far away from that in terms of quality of squad. So just a slight focus, I think, would be ideal. But I don't think Petrovic is ever going to change, as he is not going to go defensive. But yeah, so as long as they're in the league, I'm happy. But I think Sapporo fans would like a little bit of a focus there.
Yeah, no, fair enough. All right, thanks, guys. So, yeah, a bit of a bumpy ride for Sapporo this season. But, yeah, as Johnny said, this win almost certainly assures them a top flight football for 2023. And, fingers crossed for, the neutrals that Miša Petrović stays in charge. And, it's as entertaining as ever next year. And, they played at Atsibetsu, as we said. There isn't a roof on that stadium, but if there was one, it definitely would have come off in the 102nd minute when Ogashiwa won it for the black and red home team. All right, so we've mentioned that it looks like the end of Kawasaki's reign as a top flight champions, and as we said, once again it's Yokohama F Marinos who are playing spoilers as the Frontale went for a third straight title. If there was any doubt, F Marinos well and truly put it to bed that they were up for the fight on Saturday afternoon / evening away at Nagoya. And I don't know, Sam, maybe Kota Mizunuma does listen to the podcast after all. I mentioned that he might be a late bolter for the World Cup squad last week, and he went ahead and ran with that suggestion. Sliding in to fire home across from Katsuya Nagato in the 16th minute, and then he finished superbly after a brilliant first-time ball from his captain, Takuya Kida, in the first minute of the second half. So Mizunuma, known more for his assisting, of course, but two excellent goals to send F Marinos on their way away at Nagoya.
Yeah, wonderfully taken goals. I thought he played incredibly well. I thought Marinos generally were good. Once they broke down Nagoya, they got the 1-0 lead, but it was still a really tight game in that first half. But that goal at the start of the second half was, it just ended any chance of Nagoya getting back into this and kind of allowed them to play more of an expressive game and really take control. I thought the ball in from Kida was magnificent into Mizunuma, but then take nothing away from the touch and finish into the bottom corner. So, they were just linking up so well. Everything about the way the Mariners attacked in this game was just so crisp. Everyone was on the same wavelength. The movement was really good. And, Mizunuma took full advantage of that. And, hopefully he's a new listener because previous episodes of the podcast, maybe last season, I wasn't necessarily too praiseworthy of Mizunuma. I don't think you were either, Ben. So hopefully you're a new listener, Mizunuma. Welcome aboard. Join us on Patreon if you want. But it's great. Really nice from Marinos. I don't think he's going to make the World Cup squad, but surely doesn't do himself any harm with these sorts of performances.
No, you're right. I would advise Kota, don't go back and listen to too many of the older episodes because, you were never my favourite, Kota. But, I think you've turned me around. You've been absolutely terrific all season. And, two goals here to add gloss to what has been an excellent season for him, Johnny. And, we were talking in the green room and I wasn't sure whether I was going to ask this on the podcast or not. But when it comes to picking a player of the season, obviously the J-League usually follows the international convention and gives it to a player from the championship winning side, unless there is a massive outlier, i.e. Michael Olunga and his 26 goals a few years ago. When you think about candidates from Yokohama F Marinos, is Mizunuma towards the top of the list for you? Because, two goals here. He could have had a hat trick, spurned one chance in the 73rd minute when he should have hit the target, but then saw Mitch Langerak save another good effort with about 10 minutes to go. So this was a terrific performance from him and burnishing his reputation after what has been a terrific season.
Yeah, it's always nice to see a story like this, like someone who's been kind of an up and down career. As you mentioned, he was never your favourite FC Tokyo. It didn't really go so well for him there. Did some solid yeomanry at Tosu, and then since going to he was at Cerezo, he did quite well there. And then I was slightly surprised when he went to Marinos because I didn't really see him fitting in, because at that time they had like Nakagawa was at the top of his game. But he's someone who seems to get better every season he's been at Marinos. And I think that the comment I wrote after his first goal was a hot knife through butter, which I think could generally be used to describe a lot of the Marinos attacking against Nagoya. And he was a central part of it. And you said about that we're struggling to find an MVP. You could almost break convention and just give it to the Marinos as a team. But I think if you're looking for outstanding contributors, I think Tomoki Iwata, he's played the most games of any outfielder, but players in his position very rarely win individual awards. So Mizunuma, as a member of the front three, or also Elber on the other side, they've both contributed a lot. They've both started more than some of their teammates. And yes, it's been a really good performance, but yeah, they've got, like, you know, they've got two players for every position, and they've even got, like, good players like Kaina Yoshio, who's come back from a loan spell at Matches. I can hardly get in the team because they've got so many good players. And you know, Marinos had the bit between their teeth. They knew they had to win this game. They knew Frontale had dropped points against Grampus a few weeks ago, so it wasn't going to be a walkover, even though Grampus didn't have much to play for. So yeah, great stuff from Mizunuma, great stuff from Marinos, and also great stuff for Kevin Muscat, who, you know, many of us were not sure how he was going to do, but he was never an Ange Postecoglou's shadow before, because he was quite a big reputation, like, as a player, but as a coach, he certainly had a big set of shoes to step into. And if he can get one title, put himself level with his compatriot, then yeah, he's definitely exceeded my expectations. I don't know if he's exceeded others, but yeah, good times to be a Mariners fan, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And yeah, Kevin Muscat deserves all the credit that will come his way once the shield has been lifted. No question about that. He's done a superb job. And yeah, the entire F Marino squad has as well, Johnny. As you said, basically, they've got two complete units that they can plug and play. And that's terrific for Muscat to have at his disposal. And yeah, he's utilized all of his resources to almost maximum effect this season. That leaves them with still having four games to play, as do Frontale, with most of the league having just three games left. But yeah, that leaves F Marinos' magic number at 4 points, as they lead by eight. With four games to play for each of the top two. So, yeah, basically any combination of points won by F Marinos or dropped by Frontale that equal four will, see F Marinos crown champions, and that could happen as soon as this coming Saturday. So, yeah, we mentioned a couple of chances for Mizunuma to complete his hat-trick, but F Marinos wrapped up the scoring late on. It was a couple of subs who got in on the act. First, Leo Ciara dinked over the on-rushing Mitch Langerak and then passed into the empty net in the 90th minute. And then Joel Fujita drove home low to Langerak's right with literally the last kick of the game. Both of those tallies set up by fellow sub Teruhito Nakagawa, while it was also terrific to see Takuma Nishimura make his return from injury for the last half hour. So, Sam, Nishimura is another one that might get some consideration for player of the season. And obviously, some of us said, well, we'd feared that we might have seen the last of him this season after that pretty ordinary looking ankle injury he suffered. But yeah, as I said, great to see him back. And well, he played a small role in the fourth goal as well, didn't he? So good to see that he didn't seem to skip a beat on his return to action.
Yeah, wonderful powers of recovery. I think it's only been 3 weeks since he got injured. He was out for, they suggested it was 4 to 6 weeks. So fantastic that he's managed to get back and play a part in this parade, as I think he might be towards the end of the season. Yeah, he didn't look like he'd missed a beat either. I think he has been, maybe if he's not the player of the season, certainly signing of the season. Like, to pluck him out from doing nothing at Vigalta Sendai, and I blame that entirely on the manager, who decided not to play him for whatever reason. So I don't know what he was seeing in training last season. But yeah, he's just slotted in and he's done so well. He's ousted, really, Marcos Junior this season, and that would have been unthinkable maybe a season or two ago. So he's just been superb. So it's a lot of credit has to go to the Muscat's recruitment, because a lot of these signs we were looking at them at the start of the season going, all right, I'm not really certain of it. No one was picking them really to win the league, but they've just been greater than the sum of their parts. They are a complete team and a complete unit, and you could give it to Marinos as a team, as the player of the season, but I'm just going to throw in, I know he didn't make the team the half season despite me fighting for him, so I'm not sure if I'll get him to MVP, but Takuya Kida, I think, is so vital to this team, the way that he holds in midfield. It's another position that doesn't always get the recognition, but I just think he does every part of the game in midfield so well. He shields that back line, but it's not like he's just there to stop attacks. He's that, as we saw for the second goal, he can go forward and create as well. I think he is maybe the most important player in this team, if not necessarily the greatest or the best player in the team. But Kida would be my shout, and I'm just going to link it into a question we got on Patreon from Victor, who was kind of asking who is the best central midfielder in the league. He mentions Inagaki, who obviously played in this game last season's MVP, and Gakuta Notsu, who we'll come on to, but has played well this season. But for me, Kida has to be up there. Anyone that sticks out for you, John?
You've actually bailed me out there, Sam, because I wrote down Kida when I was going to make my notes to answer that question. I forgot to link in there, so thank you for that, because I was basically going to make the same point as you. I think Inagaki was great last year, but he didn't make our team of the half season this year, and I think he's been solid, but yeah, he's not. I don't think he's the best midfielder. Notsuda, yeah, he was good in the first part of the season. He is a good midfielder, but I think, yeah, Kida, Iwata, when he plays in there as well, you've got the three, Schmidt, Tachibana Dan, and Wakizaka at Kawasaki, Higuchi at Kashima, I always like as well. Okuno at Cerezo is another kind of unsung hero. And I know we're talking in the line chat before here, we maybe can't quite put Oshima in just now, but maybe you can get an honorary mention like with Yasuhito Endo. But yeah, I think, yeah, I definitely agree with you, Sam. Kida has been, yeah, he doesn't seem to play every week, but when he does play, you notice he's there. And a lot of work he does is unsung, even probably his leadership on and off the field as well, realistically. So yeah, I think he's well deserving of a good bit of praise in this section.
Yeah, most definitely. The correct answer is, of course, Koki Tsukagawa. But yeah, no, you're entitled to your shouts on Kida. And I wonder, guys, if we're asked this question again at the same time next year, I wonder whether Joel Fujita might be the correct answer, because if they can hang on to him, he looks obviously an extremely, extremely exciting prospect. And F. Marino supporters will hope that he'll be a fixture in their team for many years to come. And well, that's terrific that you've asked the first of Victor's questions there, Sam. And while we're on the subject of Nishimura, I was wondering whether he might be the player answer to Brian Smith's question about the biggest surprises, both positive and negative, from the season up to this point. I think we were probably going to address it on a team by team basis, but if you wanted to give a particular player praise for being the biggest surprise of a positive nature, then I think for me it would have to be Nishimura. Obviously, we're going to come on to talk about all the other games and all the other teams, Johnny. But if you were to pick out a player for that accolade from Brian's question, maybe we won't use a player in a negative sense. But yeah, the biggest positive surprise player you've had so far this season.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with Nishimura. If, you know, for example, someone like Mitsuta, I think it's a bit unfair because none of us really watch like university football in Japan, so it's difficult to know really what to expect. The two I've written down was Yuto Iwasaki from Sagan Tosu, who's someone who had a big reputation from sort of high school football, and I think his first year at Kyoto, but he's never really kicked on, and he's actually on loan from Sapporo, so in theory he could be a Sapporo player next year, which I actually forgot about, and he could strengthen them. And the other player I thought of was Mao Hosoya at Kashiwa. I think me and Sam have talked about a couple of times when I've been on this year. Like, he looked okay last year and the year before, but a little bit lightweight and not particularly clinical. But eight goals this year in an overperforming Kashiwa side relative to expectations. And yeah, I think if he continues his form into next year, he could well be on the plane to Europe at some point. So I think, yeah, in addition to your shout of Nishimura, I would say Iwasaki and Hosoya. What about Sam? Do you have anyone to add to that list?
First of all, you stole exactly my two answers.
Well, it must be a good answer then.
So thank you for that. The other one, I'll go back to Victor's question, actually, and he mentioned Gakuto Notsuda, who has had a really good season this year. And like previously, he's just been the player that he's been at Hiroshima since 2012, but generally he's been out on loan to various clubs. He's never found any sort of role in this Sanfrecce Hiroshima team. And to go from that and like just kind of playing in J2 or at Kofu, it was last season, and then to go from that to being like the central piece in that midfield and just running the play in Michael Skipper's system. I think that is a real surprise to me because, yeah, it just looked like it might have gone, his time may have come at Hiroshima and he wasn't really going anywhere. But yeah, he's had an incredible rise this season. I think the credit has to go to the manager for getting the best out of him in that system. But yeah, he's turned into a terrific player. So yeah, one of the better midfielders this season. I'd say he was one of my surprises.
Yeah, that's an excellent shout. And yeah, the fact that he even made it into the Victor's short list of two, it says a lot, of course, about Notsuda's reinvention under Michael Skipper at Hiroshima this season. So yeah, the top two dealt with then. And as we said, F. Marino's 8 points clear. They have four games to play, as do Kawasaki. Hiroshima moved level on points with the Frontale on 54. They have three games left to play after they swept aside Urawa Reds 4-1 at home on Saturday afternoon, and that's the game that we'll move on to next. Hiroshima tightened their grip on third place, as we'll come on to later. It wasn't the best of endings of the weekend for Cerezo Osaka, but for Hiroshima, yes, it was a polished performance and a thoroughly deserved win. Tsukasa Morishima prodded them into the lead in the 22nd minute after dawdling at the back between Shusaku Nishikawa and Ken Iwao was punished. Reds almost drew level in first half stoppage time, but Keisuke Osako did well to save down low from Tomoaki Okubo fierce drive, but Sanfrecce went 2-0 up just past the hour when defender Hayato Araki poked home a low cross from Morishima after a corner was headed out of the box and Yusuke Chajima's shot was deflected. Then in the 71st minute, young sensation Makoto Mitsuta lashed in another special, this time after being played in by new man of the moment and his new rival for attention, Takumu Kawamura. Unlike their women's team on Saturday, there was no way back from 3-0 down for Reds, but shortly after, a brilliant double save from Osako denied him. Brian Linson's back header was nodded in by Kai Shibato for a consolation goal to get it back to 3-1. But Mitsuta, though, would have the last laugh, quite literally, catching out Nishikawa with a free kick from well beyond 30 yards, and yes, as I said earlier, after Cerezo's draw, tighten their grip on third spot in the table. So, our Kakichino 11, Ralph, certainly made the right decision to go and watch Reds ladies and see them lift the Wii League Cup after, as I said, coming back from 3-0 down. But, yes, it just was one of those days, unfortunately, for the Reds supporters who made the journey down to Hiroshima, Johnny, and Hiroshima proved that, as they've done pretty much all season, that, yes, they definitely are top three material. And, at this rate, they could even overtake Kawasaki before the season's over.
Going by my memory, I think this means that Sanfrecce have scored 9 goals in my last two pod appearances. So I don't know if the fans want to organise a whip round or something, and maybe if they raise enough money, I could be on more often. But at least this time, it's not 5 goals against my team I have to talk about, as it was the last time I was on. But I think this game kind of reminded me of, I think, near the start of Rodriguez's reign last year, that they lost 3-0 to Ange Postecoglou's Marinos. And it was like the playing out from the back was just made to order for Marinos with a high press, and they just won the ball again and again and again in Reds' defensive third. And then Skipper's gegenpressing, again, it was all over Reds, and the amount of times they won possession and were able to put them under pressure near their own goal was incredible. And, yeah, I mean, you could argue the scoreline might slightly flatter Hiroshima with the amount of like spectacular goals, but they are scoring these spectacular goals regularly. Like Mitsuda's finish, his first one was a brilliant like clean strike, and then the second one's, yeah, I know Nishikawa's positioning, he'll be angry with himself, but yeah, from that distance, it's sort of, was it 35 yards out? It's a phenomenal strike. And even when they were challenged at the back, Osako came up with a few good saves. So yeah, it's a good afternoon's work for Hiroshima. And it's interesting because, you know, we were talking about Kawasaki earlier, and they were relying on their wide players for goals. Again, no centre forward for Hiroshima has been particularly prolific. Like Douglas Vieira started and he missed a good chance. And then they've had 8 goals from Mitsuda and 8 goals from Morishima. That's really been the engine room of their success. And I think the last thing I wanted to say about them, I'm being nice to Ralph, I'm not really mentioning Reds too much, I'll just go on to Hiroshima. But I again, talking about Ange Postecoglou, I see sort of similarities with how Michael Skibbers come in, and there's not been a lot of new signings, and people like Kawamura, Taishi Matsumoto, Notsuda, they were all in the sort of Hiroshima setup in the past. He's got the absolute maximum out of them. He's even taken people like Morishima to the next level in a similar way to Postecoglou did with maybe people like Ken Matsubara or Ogiwara, Kida, Keita Endo. He sort of developed them, and he didn't just go out and buy loads of new players. He also developed the players who were already there. So, yes, Skiba and Hiroshima, clearly big, big surprises this year. Everything's going pretty well. Reds, I think they need to remember there's still four games to go. They don't want to completely fall away. And, yeah, I was kind of wondering, Sam, I mean, would you go on with what I'm saying about Hiroshima? And also, Ricardo Rodriguez at Reds, I mean, how much pressure is going to be going on him like going into next season? Because ninth, or they could go eighth if they win their game in hand. It's not really what Reds fans were looking for, despite the ACL successes this year.
No, well, first with Hiroshima, I think, yeah, absolutely. He's just done it. He's had a clear idea of exactly what he wants. Everyone has bought into it, and he's got the absolute max out of every one of those players. I think it's been fantastic to watch Kawamura and Notsuda. Yeah, they're players that, yeah, you don't really expect a great deal of. This was a team that was stagnating and just dropping and dropping and dropping. And they bottom when Skipper comes in. And the job he's done has been magnificent. But, yeah, for Reds, yeah, Ralph, you might want to turn off, actually. They were horrible. Like, they've had a really poor season. They're up in ninth. They had that one spell in and around those Champions League games where they looked like they'd hit on something and it was working. But because they built a team on basically really hard runners and hard workers, they'll press, and it got results in the Champions League. They carried that on for a couple of games in the league. I then said, oh, they might be a real danger at the end of the season. How wrong was that? But they've gone away from that. If you're going to play hard runners, they have to work hard, and they have forgot to in the last few games. They've just not bothered. It was so easy for Hiroshima. They're always going to press you. And yeah, you can play out from the back, and it can work against a gegenpress if you work it properly. But you have to be kind of proactive in that. Not just the first goal is so casual at the back. Yes, you can play out to Iwao, but then the slow, undercooked return to Nishikawa is just so poor. And they just weren't on it all game. And Rodriguez has to come under pressure because they have so many good players. They have so many resources. This should be a team that's challenging for the title. And it should not be a team that has languished in the bottom half of the table all season, had a small burst to do quite well in the Asian Champions League, which I think is keeping him in a job at the moment. But there's just been no real sign. He's just gone back to a team that is kind of set up to escape relegation. That's what you do when you're struggling. You go to a really hard-working team and just to get out of it. And with the quality that he has in that squad, and it's still really odd to see Kasper Juncker always on the bench or to see him out of the squad when he's saying on Twitter that he's fit, and Moberg will then drop out and Schalke will drop out. I don't know what's going on there. I know Scott McIntyre has his theories that he's aired on this podcast before, and I don't know how much I agree or disagree with all of them, but there is something clearly quite wrong there behind the scenes, and this Reds team should be playing much better football than it is, rather than trying to rely on willing runners and even not now getting the best out of those. So, yeah, a lot of questions are being asked. A Champions League win will probably keep him till next season. But that next season, they have to be challenging for the title with the resources they have, because this season has absolutely not been good enough. And this game was just a microcosm of that. Every one of the four goals, although Hiroshima played well, Reds just did not play well for any of these four goals. The second goal, they don't deal with a corner, which I don't think I've ever seen a Reds team deal with a corner. And I don't know why that's not been addressed. Nobody reacts to the second ball. He goes out and Iraki is there to score. The second one, yes, it's good play from Mitsuno. It's a good finish. But Iwanami, first of all, is miles out of position. And he sprints then to try and meet Mitsuno. But the kind of sprints past him. It's an easy touch from Mitsuno and then a good finish. And then the fourth one, yeah, it's poor from Nishikawa. So just generally a really dreadful performance from Urawa. And there are so many questions that need to be addressed, either with a change of manager or by Rodriguez in this coming off season.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? I mean, they had the best defense in terms of goals against in J1 before this match day began, and they finished it in second place behind F Mariners after shipping four here. But yeah, for me, they're a podium finisher for Brian Smith's question about the biggest surprises in a negative sense in J1 at least this season. And as you've both said, yeah, for the yes, the resources, the players they have at their disposal, the squad, it's almost too big, isn't it? I mean, yeah, Rodriguez, he either doesn't know his best team, or he just wants more new players because he's not happy with the ones he's got and he's unable to get rid of some of them. I don't know, but yeah, it's a real conundrum, and for Red supporters, yeah, it must be really, really frustrating. And obviously we're a week-to-week podcast here, so we react positively to a good performance and negatively to a bad one. So this was a particularly bad one for Reds, and we start to ask questions about the manager and I guess, yeah, the setup as a whole. But I'm sure Red supporters are doing so themselves after such a disappointing display. And yes, what's almost certain now to be a mid-table finish. We thought they might be able to give the top six a nudge. That's looking very unlikely. They have four games to play. But yes, for example, 6 points behind sixth place to FC Tokyo. So it's frustrating for Reds, but we have to give Hiroshima their credit. And well, yes, as I said earlier, Sam, when I asked Johnny about this game, Hiroshima might even get above Frontale by the end of the season. And in terms of qualifying for the ACL, that could obviously be vital, as you spelled out for Johnny and I in the green room. And you needed to just explain it twice to me, so please do it again for the listeners. Third place might not be enough to get an automatic ACL qualification spot. So, yeah, if Hiroshima can jump above Frontale and finish second and lock up an ACL spot, well, then that would certainly represent an epic first season for Michael Skibber.
Yeah, it absolutely would, and it does potentially come vital to finishing second, because, as we know, the top three and the Emperor's Cup winner currently qualify for the Asian Champions League. However, if Reds go on to win the Asian Champions League, they get one of those four spots, and they're not going to finish in the top three to affect that. So, if Reds do that, and Hiroshima don't win the Emperor's Cup, say if Kashima win the Emperor's Cup, then they would qualify for the ACL, so that would be Kashima, Urawa, and then the top two. So yes, finishing third, you could then end up outside of the Asian Champions League spaces, which seems a tad unfair, but yeah, it does breathe a bit more life into this season, as Hiroshima in their current form could easily overtake Kawasaki at the end of this season.
Indeed. Thanks for, yeah, once again, setting that out for me. And I'm sure the listeners appreciate it as well. And that makes Cerezo Osaka's task even harder after their draw at home to Shonan on Saturday. But we'll come on to that game a little bit later. So with the top three handled, we'll now move down to the relegation dogfight. Things got particularly down and dirty on Saturday afternoon, though, of course, we did, as I said at the top of the episode, lose the Shimizu versus Iwata game that had to be postponed. But yes, a couple of huge wins down in the dogfight. Unfortunately, one of them wasn't for your team, Gamba Osaka, Johnny, but we will begin at the Best Denki Stadium in Fukuoka, where Avispa hosted Kobe in one of the relegation six-pointers from the match day. It kicked off at 2 o'clock, and Kobe's recent revival continued after Yuki Kobayashi, the midfielder, not the defender, arrived to power home a header past Masaki Murakami in the 21st minute. Previously, Yuya Osako had fired just over with an early chance. But Johnny, yes, Kobe have looked like they've done a Houdini act here. They've timed their run to perfection, and they've obviously papered over a lot of cracks that were bare for all to see earlier on into the season, and yeah, up until basically four match days ago. But it looks like they are going to perform the great escape, and Kobayashi was the hero on Saturday afternoon.
Well, yeah, this was a beautiful goal, and I think all three players that were kind of immediately involved in the goal, Osako with his lovely touch to bring it down and pass to Yuriki, it was a lovely cross, and then Kobayashi, what a header, and that's 10 points in four games for Kobe. What I will say, though, that VCL Kobe play the top three in their last four games. And what Sam's just told us about that, Kawasaki and Sam Frecci both going for second, puts a whole new kind of spell on that, because Kawasaki away in the second last game of the season, even if the league's gone, that's a tough game. Mariners at home, the last game. Next week is against Sam Frecci. And then, so the one game they've got is Shonan at home. If they don't beat Shonan, then, you know, they're only 3 points above Fukuoka. It would be difficult to see both Fukuoka and Gamba going by them, I would grant you. But if they don't win that Shonan game, then they're not safe yet. So I think definitely Kobe have turned it around, and with the kind of players and resources they have, as they should have, it's about time, their fans will be saying. But yeah, they're not out of the woods just yet, despite a very positive result here, and also in their previous game, another win against a relegation battler. So things are looking up, but yeah, I think they need to keep the focus on. They don't want to do perhaps what Shimizu did and get a couple of good results and then sort of relax a bit too much. So yeah, I think Kobe probably won't be involved in the bottom three, but don't they shouldn't count their chickens just yet, I think is what I'm trying to say.
No, agreed there. And hopefully the managers drummed that into the players that, yeah, after three straight wins, they can't afford to get complacent, because they are literally just 3 points above 16th place, the Fukuoka. Their opponents on Saturday, so they were level at kickoff, Sam. And as Johnny said, it was a terrific goal from Kobayashi. Fukuoka had their chances to equalize and will be hugely frustrated that they weren't able to take any of them. And yet another frustrating result. And as you said, it's they're now into 16th spot in the table, slipped back after their win in the previous game. So they've certainly got it all to do in the their remaining three games. And we've had quite a few questions about Fukuoka. Some of them you and Johnny need a refresher course on Aussie slang. But it's certainly looking a difficult road to hoe for Fukuoka. Do you hold out much hope that they will be still kicking alive and kicking in J1 at the end of match day 34?
Oh, who knows? That's what I say with this relegation bout. Like, they're there for a reason, and it was evident against Kobe. They had the chances, but they just can't score goals. They're the joint lowest scorers in the league, and when you're in that position, you're always going to be in trouble. I think there was one question that suggested, like, is that a surprise that Avispera would be to go down? And I think maybe to a degree, in that they look like they'd settled their problem by signing Lukian with the amount of goals he scored in J2 last season. But he just really has not worked, and that has been a crucial part of why Avispa are down there. Do I back them to... But the nice thing is, it doesn't matter how many times you can't score, they've got Sapporo next to will give you 1,000 chances. So that's an interesting game. They then play Kashua, who are ending the season not great, and Reds, who have just gone off on for a few minutes. So the fixture list on it, paper, looks okay. It's just there's so many variables in this relegation battle. I'm not sure which way to go with any of this. At the moment, I would be leaning towards Avispa being in either 16th or 17th. The only silver lining I can give them in terms of that is that 16th is so heavily weighted to the J1 team that it's not necessarily the end of the world if you do finish in that position. But I just think the lack of goal scorers in that team is a real detriment, and they are a little bit more shaky at the back now for whatever reason. I know that Nara a few weeks ago had that really poor tackle in the game against F. Marinos, and he got some abuse on social media because of that, and he hasn't featured since. And if you take Nara out of that defence, he's such a good player, then yeah, they've got Mia and Crawley who are decent, but you take one third out of that and it really weakens them defensively. And I think they were pulled apart a little too easily at times by Kobe. I think Osako does do that, and I think he did it for the goal in terms of bringing Crawley out, which then left the space for Kobayashi to go into. So yeah, if there are problems at the back as well as them not scoring, then I really do fear for them. So, yeah, I learned some Aussie slang to try and answer one of the questions. I think it was from Daniel. And upper gum tree is the Aussie phrase I found. I don't know if that means anything, but that's my answer.
Yes, well, Daniel wondered, on a scale of she'll be right to where Gonski, where do we think Avispa sit? Yeah, they're not quite up a gum tree, I don't think. But yes, not far. Yeah, they might be beginning to scale it, Sam, at the moment. As you said, the shortage of goals has, yes, become a chronic issue. And, yeah, they're the joint lowest scorers in J1 with the Shonan after they've played 31 games. But you could still literally throw a blanket over six teams from a 17th-placed Gumba up to 12th-placed Kobe. There's just 4 points between those teams. So, yeah, there's still, no definitive answers yet in the dogfight other than, as we said earlier, it looks like Sapporo have well and truly escaped. But, Fukuoka, their fixture list looks promising enough. And if they're good enough, as Gabanello suggests, they might be, then they might just do it. And as it was spelt out in the last episode of Extra Time when Sean Carroll joined John Steele, yes, it's the playoff is still so heavily weighted in the J1 team's favour. And yes, the official policy of the J-Talk podcast is that we are against that and would like to see a fair playoff done on a neutral ground, and may the best team win. But apparently the J-League still does not think that is the right way to go about things. So another huge win down in the dogfight came at the real estate agent in front of the station stadium, and it was a Kyoto Sanga who also won away from home 1-0. This was against Tosu, and it was a terrific goal from Yuta Toyokawa in the 17th minute that proved to be the difference between the teams. A terrific goal with his left foot from the edge of the box, flashed in past Park Il-gyu and went in off his left-hand post. Just Toyokawa's second league goal of the season, Johnny, but without question, hit the most important and a hugely important goal for Sanga that took them out of 16th and all the way up to 13th. So they kind of latched on to Kobe's coattails. And I mean, we've said it in recent episodes, there can be no question over Kyoto's commitment to staying up. And the manager Chokwi Jay is obviously the best equipped manager in a situation like this. And his side got a priceless 3 points away at Tosu on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, it's hard to overstate how big a win this is for Kyoto. And I'm not really sure why, because they're not the highest of the teams in the sort of relegation battle group. But having seen their fixtures and having seen this game, I'm most confident about them now staying up after spending all season sure they were going to go down. Like, there was Utaka was an unused sub, but I think he must have lingering effects of COVID or something, because he's just not really been used since that midsummer cluster they had, and Paulinho Boya wasn't even in the squad. But Toyokawa, who's a player, I think he always irritates me, because whenever Sam and I are doing the transfer market market value analysis, like, I always think his value is way too high, and no one seems to agree with me, so it doesn't come down as much as I want it to. But he is a priceless goal, a lovely touch, lovely turn and lovely finish. And I think the other week or a few weeks back, Yamazaki did a similar goal. They're just pulling rabbits out of hats at the right time, and after quite a poor run. I think that's two wins, a draw, and two losses in their last five. And like Kobe, Shimizu, Shonan, they've played a game less than Fukuoka and Gamba, which gives them an advantage. So yeah, Tosu, again, the kind of team you want to play at this time of the year, 8th place. Even though it's away from home, it's a tough game. They've gone there, they've done the business. Yeah, fair play to them. That's a brilliant result for them.
Yeah, brilliant stuff. And we feared for them, Sam. But yes, as I said, you can't doubt their commitment. And Cho will have them fired up for every one of their last four league games. And their fixture list looks reasonable on paper. Certainly, if you stack it up against Kobe's, they both have to play Kawasaki. But apart from that, Kyoto, it's spelt out for them. And as I said, with Fukuoka, they're obviously 2 points better off than them. But yeah, if they're good enough, then they'll do it. And Saturday is obviously a great start to kickstarting the last stages of their season.
I just want to give full credit to the way that Cho has gone about this, because they were in free fall going through that middle of the season period and all that COVID stuff that they've had to come through. They've got so many injuries as well in this squad, but he's just managed to galvanise them. It's not the greatest looking squad on paper, but they work so hard. They keep themselves in games. I thought they managed to score some really good goals as well. Toyokawa's goal is terrific in this game, and he's getting the best out of what, with the greatest respect to Toyokawa, Yamasaki and the like, are kind of average players. They're not the greatest ever. And they've even dealt with Peter Utaka, who was like the talisman for the start of the season. He's gone off the ball. Yes, I think that COVID case has really affected him. He's barely played. I think he played 45 minutes in one game, and that's all he's really managed after that. So, yeah, just they've not had it easy, Kyoto, but they have come through it really well. And, yeah, just I think it is the manager that has managed to drag them out of this. And, yeah, the fixtures are okay, and I've like Johnny, I have quite a lot of confidence in Kyoto now staying up after saying I was the most worried about them for most of the season.
No, fair enough then. All right, so yeah, huge kudos to Kyoto. And yeah, as I said, they've set themselves up for their last four games. And an excellent chance. Who has an excellent chance in the dogfight? Who knows? It obviously can turn on a week-to-week basis. And, literally they were 16th before the match day began. And, before we leave this game, gentlemen, going off on a little bit of a tangent, as some of our listeners might be aware, a Sagan Tosu youngster, Taichi Fukui, is making a move to Bayern Munich in the winter. So that certainly took me by surprise. Don't know a massive amount about Fukui, but obviously if he's turned the head of Bayern Munich and their scouts, then there must certainly be a player there. So, Sam, I'll come back to you. What can you tell our listeners about Fukui and about this move? And, he's obviously not going to walk straight into the Bayern Munich first team. But, what does a move like this, and I don't know whether he'll be loaned out or not, but what does this mean for him? And is there a pathway opening from the J-League into some of the biggest clubs in Germany now?
Potentially. I mean, I don't know a great deal about this Fukui. He's played a few League Cup ties, and this season he's barely been involved with the team. I think he's been over in Germany training with Bayern Munich for a fair period now, so they have had a very good look at him. And they have this kind of policy. Generally, it's been with Korean players that go into the Bayern youth teams. They build them up for a few years. Eventually, they get decent loans out, and you see that kind of spread of a few Korean players now in Germany. So hopefully this is the start of them looking at maybe more Japanese prospects and doing likewise with them. And I mean, you can't think of a better club to go and work at when you're 18 and Bayern Munich with the players that they have, if he gets to interact with any of those first team players and can build his game there. But on a personal level, I've not seen him play, but the Bayern scouts must have seen something. So I think we can be excited by it. I don't expect to see him rocking up against Borussia Dortmund, but I think it is really exciting for him. So I'm really intrigued by it. But yeah, I can't really offer a great deal in terms of what sort of player he is or how I expect him to do there.
Yeah, can you shed any light on Fukui, Johnny, or how you think he might get on over there? It's a fascinating move, and if not, you could maybe segue onto another part of Victor's question about how does Sagan keep producing such talented youngsters? It's really impressive for a smaller, in inverted commas, J1 club.
I know a little bit about Fukui, so I'll start on that and then go on to Tosu. I believe. I'm not sure what his actual status is, but last year he was in one of those type 2 amateur contracts because he was a second grade high school student, and he started this year on one of those contracts as well, and then they announced a few months into the season he turned pro. I believe that is so they could get a fee from Bayern of some sort. I think Nakano, the defender, they did that with too, but I believe he was still, they've got some sort of arrangement in Japan where you can play football and study at school. They sort of work around that. Don't ask me how it works exactly, but I believe his age is still of a high school student, which is why I think he's joining from next year. I don't know how stereotypical this is, but the German media labelled him as the next Shinji Kagawa. So that I'm basing his play style on Kagawa. He's obviously not a holding midfielder. He's more of a playmaker, but again, that could be a bit of lazy journalism, which I think goes around the world from time to time. In terms of Tosu's youth team, I think probably partially out of necessity, because they don't have the money to go out and sign big players, and they're regularly stripped of, like, asset stripped of talent. But they do seem to have, like, an excellent youth system, and Kyushu as an area is very famous for producing athletes in various different sports in Japan. If you're honest, I mean, Saga has a reputation in Japan for not being the most lively or exciting place, and other than Saga and Tosa, I'd struggle to tell you anything famous from Saga Prefecture. So a bit like, you know, with Otani, and I think it's at Roki Sasaki, that pitchers from Aomori, that there's not a whole lot to do there. So if you're a young kid growing up in Saga, you've got Juku, like cram school, or you've got your sport. So I think a lot of these kids, there's not really much distractions. They just get their head down. They've got good training. They've got good pathways into the top team. And yeah, without knowing a ton of what goes on there, I think that's as good an outline as I can really give into Fukui and Tosu. So I hope that's okay for the listeners and what they're looking for.
Yeah, yeah, brilliant stuff, Johnny. Yeah, so, I mean, it is remarkable, isn't it, Sam? Because as Johnny says, they're regularly gutted of their best players, either to Europe or to, other J1 clubs, in inverted commas, bigger clubs. They're my inverted commas, not Victor's. But, yeah, it's a pipeline that has obviously served them extremely well. And, without any huge names in their squad this season, they're settled in for another comfortable mid-table finish. And I think year to year some people expect them to drop off, but when they're producing youngsters of this quality, then as long as the management's right and giving them, you know, taking care of them, then they look set to continue at mid-table at worst for a long period to come.
Yeah, absolutely. They're basically another one of those positive surprises for this season. I think might be locked into that for a while now, Saga and Tosu, because everyone expects them to get relegated at the start of every season because they've lost 75% of their players. But they just managed to regenerate, whether it is through their youth system, whether it's good pickups from university, which they're very good at, or whether it is plucking unfancied or unheralded players from maybe J2 or whatnot and just fixing them to the style of play that they want to play at. They've just been so good at it, and just have to give a lot of credit to the kind of whole system there, because it's such a difficult place to, you'd imagine, with everything going around, the lack of finances or the turmoil that has been around Saga and Tosu, it must be an incredibly difficult situation to work in. But how everyone has kind of banded together and to have created teams that play really nice football and are challenging at the top end of the J-League, I think is a real credit to everyone involved with that. So yeah, long may it continue, but I would like them just to be able to hold on to a player or two for a little bit longer.
Well, yeah, if they had an all-star game, then Tosu could put together an all-star team of players that they've lost. Yeah, they could piece together one hell of a team. There's no question about that, Sagan. But they're losing Fukui before they've even really got to know him. But for the club, it's another feather in their cap. And we'll be watching on to see how he gets on at Bayern in the future. All right. So unfortunately, though, Johnny, we'll have to move on to talk about the two draws involving a relegation dogfight teams on Saturday. And the first is your team's game at the Panasonic Stadium at home against Kashiwa. Your side was able to welcome back Takashi Usami. Sam had questioned Alan Gibson about his potential availability a couple of weeks ago. Usami, of course, was out since match day 3 and playing, his first game in 7 months, and lined up in the tunnel with the armband on, and looked full of intent and raring to go. You must have been extremely excited to see him back on the pitch. No question about that. And before we talk about the game as a whole, what sort of an impact was he able to have in his 70 odd minutes on the pitch? And were you surprised he got through that much?
Yeah, I was really surprised. I thought he would start on the bench and maybe come on for the last 15 or 20 minutes, because it was a bad, bad injury he had. And you know, it seems like so long ago now, because at the time he left the field, Gamba were 1-0 up against Kawasaki, and they were set to go for the first 3 games against Kashima Reds and Kawasaki with 6 points. But it didn't end up happening, and then it's kind of the season's drifted from then. I wasn't really sure what kind of impact to have. He looked sharper and fitter than I expected, given I thought he'd start on the bench. It's kind of been interesting, because since Joan Alano's come in from Kashima, he looked really good down that right flank. And it's been a big upgrade because Onose, I think, had been going through the motions for too long. But then Yuki Yamamoto came back in and the sort of focus shifted a little bit to the middle. And I think with Usami coming in, it definitely gave something in attack, because when he was subbed by Patrick, you had 20 minutes of Patrick and Pereira. And I think, as you said last time, Sam, or it was maybe two weeks ago, that I think that they got away with playing those two for a couple of weeks, but there's not really much subtlety or guile about that. So it's defences have worked out. So someone like Usami in there playing with Pereira, it didn't quite come off, because I think him and Pereira both were kind of wayward with their shooting. But a lot of Gamba's attacking play came through the middle, involving Yamamoto and Usami, and Alano had one of his quieter games. So I'd like to see a kind of system where they get Yamamoto, Usami and Alano working together. And also, I'd like to see Isa Sakamoto maybe come back in, or Yamami come back into the squad. But it seems like Matsuda's gone for as basic a game plan as he can get, and he's got his favourites, and that he's not going to change. So we'll have to wait till next season. But yeah, great to see Usami back. Unfortunately, he couldn't be the hero with a goal, though.
Well, he did have a couple of chances, though, didn't he? And Sam, well, this game, it's pretty remarkable that it ended 0-0. So many chances at either end of the pitch, and some slightly wayward finishing that certain players would be looking back on with regret. But there was also some terrific goalkeeping on display as well. And Masato Sasaki made some decent saves for Reysol. But yes, Masaaki Higashiguchi has done superbly to keep out a couple of Douglas efforts, one in each half. And then, well, he had to make a couple of saves from the Reysol sub, Yuki Muto, in second half stoppage time. So, so many chances at either end. Leandro Pereira, a number for Gamba, but unable to beat Sasaki. And on Higashiguchi, another question from Gabanello, Sam. He wonders, is Higashiguchi the best keeper in J-League hands down? He's got some pretty fierce competition, I'd say, Gab. But on a performance like Saturday's, Higashiguchi is definitely in the running for that title, Sam.
Yeah, he definitely can be. I mean, these sorts of performances, like last season, it was almost every game Higashiguchi was playing in this manner. Obviously, he's had all of his injury issues this season. It may have taken him a little bit to kind of get up to speed, but this performance was magnificent. The one save, I don't know how much he really knows about it, but when Douglas heads for about 2 yards out and manages to stretch himself out and get a knee on it or a thigh on it and get it clear, it was just a magnificent save. And there were just a lot of those, even the one where I think it was a Matheus Savio volley. Higashiguchi gets down really well to save that, and then up to save the Hosoya rebound as well. I thought he was magnificent. Whether he is the best goalkeeper in the league, definitely not hands down, and you know I'm a big rap for Mitch Langerak, so I would probably just still side with Langerak, but Higashiguchi has the ability to produce special performances, and that was one of these, because yeah, he kept Gamba in it at times, and at the other end it was just a lack of finishing really from Gamba. I thought Usami coming in, it allows Leandro Pereira to play in a different manner. It's not always just launched up to him and he has to deal with that, because his movement is not terrible when he's got someone playing in behind him, and he got into the channels a few times. It's just, yeah, finishing kind of let him down, but you can see a path to goal with that, and that you could see that maybe with time, I know they haven't got time, but with time that partnership could develop into a decent one. So I thought this was a generally pretty good game, but Gamba's finishing let them down, and Higashiguchi's goalkeeping let Kashiwa down.
Indeed, but well, we can't let this pass, Johnny, without referencing the fact that while it did end 0-0, of course, Gamba did have the ball in the net in the 44th minute when Usami swung over a corner to the far post. It was controlled by Ryotaro Meshino on his chest, and then he fired in low at the near post despite Sasaki's attempts to save it. He'd get a hand on it, but the ball went into the net. It appeared to me that the referee initially appeared to award the goal, point to the centre circle, but then blew his whistle, and then after a couple of minute VAR check, it was determined that the ball had struck Meshino's arm as he brought it under control. Very line ball, to say the least. A clear and obvious error, I'm not sure, but certainly a horrible decision to cop, Johnny, when your team is scrambling for any points, let alone any goals you can get, and you might have just had a perfectly legitimate one chalked off there.
I might surprise you by actually slightly disagreeing. I think the right decision has been reached, and the main reason I have for that is Meschino's reaction.
Uh-huh.
In Gamba's situation, if Meschino genuinely thought he hadn't handballed the ball, he would have been in the referee, and that would have brought the experienced players like Usami, Shoji, Pereira. They would all have been hounding the referee. Even when the goal's given and then the whistle's blown, the look Meschino gives says to me he has handled the ball. And I think a lot of Gamba fans, that they accepted that, yeah. I think because the assistant disallows the goal, like puts the flag up, and they actually disallow it. So I believe that the goal was disallowed. Then they checked in VAR, and it looked like it might have probably hit his hand. I think Gamba fans are at the stage with VAR after various incidents this year that they kind of believe we need to get a dodgy decision in our favour, and that would have been one. I think there's another one. There were slight complaints about Kamijima had a hold of Pereira's shirt when what would have been a dog saw, and I think he lets go of the shirt just in time and Pereira kind of puts his hand on him. But yeah, I think Gamba really needed that, as unfair as that would have been to Kashua. Yeah, we really needed that to go in our favour, but it's just been that kind of season. Like I know, I'm sure opposing fans can look at Gamba and say, you know, they've had chance after chance to put in a good performance or to kill games off or not concede silly goals, and they haven't taken any of them. So you can't go relying on VAR. But, you know, but what happened at Kobe the previous game, I think that's really just kind of flattened everyone to do with the club. So even they sing in the stadium, they do Sammy back, the performance was still a bit flat. And I think, honestly, I haven't seen the highlights of this game. I just watched it in full. I think the highlights might be slightly, I get the feeling they might be slightly misleading, because Kashiwa tended to have chances in bunches. Like, they had a good 10-minute spell in the first half, and then they kept catching Gamba on the break towards the end. But for a lot of the game, I think Kashiwa didn't really get out of second gear. You know, between Gamba and Kashiwa combined, there was over 1,000 passes completed in the game. It wasn't as intense. It was a decent game, but I expected more intensity from Gamba. And also, Kashiwa before the game were technically still in with a shout of third. So I just expected a bit more from both teams. And the game kind of happened at parts. So there was lots of nice passing, but you know, there's only three games to go now. So I just expected a bit more from both teams, if I'm honest. What did you think, Sam?
Yeah, it was. But I just don't know if the way the Gamba is set up, it doesn't really scream all out attack, let's go for it or anything. They've got their kind of basic system. They're going to work through it, and they believe that it will eventually provide a result. Often when Gamba have won with this system, it's because they've gone ahead early. And then I don't know if there's necessarily a game plan, a plan B or a switch that they have worked on that would suggest what do we do if it's 0-0 after 60 minutes. So it just seems like they've got one idea of how to go about it, and they're not really been able to stray from that. And Kashiwa are in a position where it's not vital that they win. Yes, there was a chance they could have finished third, but they've kind of been off it for a little while now, and it's not like they're really desperate for a victory either. So it didn't really produce an altogether great game of football. I just think that, but it is the more onus has to be on Gamba in this situation. It is quite worrying if they're not able to switch from this one way of playing. And I just don't know how they are going to go about this, because I'm looking at their fixtures now. If Marinov next, is it a write-off or something? I don't know. You can't really write it off, but I just don't see this way of playing causing Marinov any difficulty. So are they just saying, we'll wait to these final two games? Jubilo is a good one that we can win, and then Kashima are a team that aren't really playing football and haven't for a while. So I don't know if they're just seeing it out at that point and just trying to pick up and happy with the point at this stage. Because, yeah, it didn't really show as a team that was desperate. They're in a dire situation and absolutely had to win it. So, yeah, it's an interesting one. If you can't get up for it in the situation that they're in, then, yeah, I do worry for Gamba.
I think that's four home games in a row that they haven't scored, which is... It seems to be teams that just sit in like Kashiwa did. There's no way to break through it, which at least, obviously we'll probably talk about Marinos more later, but Marinos will come on to Gamba. And it's worth noting that Gamba have played a very similar counter-attack strategy the last 2 years and have won the last two games away to Marinos. So there is a bit of hope there. Jubilo, I think everyone listening to this is probably thinking that screams 0-0. And then Kashima is strange because everything should say Kashima should be an easier game than Marinos. But you know how if you've seen something happen recently, you can imagine it more. Like, I went to Nissan Stadium last year and saw a not very good Gamba side beat Marinos with three of the back four missing. You know, with Suganuma and Sato and Yanagisawa on the back four, and we went and won 1-0. But whereas Kashima, we've had a horrible record. We lost them home and away in the Levan Cup. We lost them in the Emperor's Cup with all the Suzuki and Patrick nonsense in the opening day of the season. I know, like, yeah, sort of, that's the easier game to win. But for some reason in my head, the Marinos is the easiest of the last three to win. Yeah, we'll see. But yeah, I think as a Gamba fan, I was looking, as you say, I was looking for a bit more intensity. I was looking for more ideas. That the only two shots after half time, no shots in the last 23 minutes. They just sort of petered out into nil-nil, which, you know, 4 points off Kashiwa this season is okay. That's not the reason we'd go down, but they really needed to win this game. And a bit like, you know, like FC Tokyo and Tosu we played in recent weeks, they're all good teams, they're all in the top half, but none of them were quite 100% motivated. So there was chances to win all of those games, and they've taken 2 points from three games.
Yeah, and I wonder if you're going to be looking back and ruining those single points where, three would have been obviously priceless for your side, Johnny. So, it's obviously great to have Usami back, but the three very contrasting fixtures to come. And, if you can get anything at all, obviously, away at the Nissan Stadium on Saturday, well, then hopefully that sets you up for the final two games when we return after the two cup finals are played. But, in your worst nightmares, did you imagine that your team would be second from bottom with three games to play? I mean, I don't know what the sort of reservations you had about the squad back at the start of the season. My memory is not as photographic as yours, and I can't remember what sort of a vibe you had at the start of the campaign. But yeah, I can't imagine that it could have gone much worse for your team. And similar to what I said for Kobe, Kyoto and Fukuoka, if they're good enough, they'll get out of it. But the situation you're in at the moment, it's surely the thing of nightmares.
I think the phrase I used in the pre-season preview was a non-JPRED team, meaning that between 5th and 15th. So, I mean, I guess if 15th was the floor, we're not that much lower than the floor. I think that the big game was round three, wasn't it, at home to Kawasaki. You know, we lost it to Kashima round one. We nicked an away win at Urawa. 1-0 up, and Usami did his Achilles, and then Mitsuki Saito played his first game and he wasn't fully fit, so they both went off at the same time. We lost momentum and then somehow got 2-1 up, and then with the unfortunate incident with Ishikawa. So there's many a night I've kind of sat home tossing and turning, thinking, imagine Ishikawa just boots the ball clear, Usami's still fit, we go to Iwata in round three, win there, you've got 9 points from four games, it's a completely different season. But obviously, that didn't happen. Katanasaka was never able to connect with the players or get his ideas across. I think, as Sam said about Matsuda, his ideas are very limited. But, you know, if you're coming in with like 8-9 games to go, he's obviously gone for the simplest basic instructions that the players do understand what they're meant to do. It's just maybe the other team understands what they're meant to do a bit too easily. There needs to be a gutting out, a clearing out, regardless if Gamba stay up or go down. There's, I think, there's 31 players in the squad. There's just too many. There's too many experienced players not even making the match day squad. I think they need to invest a bit more in youth, university players, hungry players, and get in a young kind of manager who's give them a bit of time and build something as. Nishino is the obvious example to go for, maybe not necessarily as successful as him, but Gamba is just crying out for new ideas, new blood. And if it means going down to J2 to bring them back stronger, then we'll accept that. But yes, it's been a horrible, horrible season so far.
All right, well, thanks for that, Johnny. And yeah, we've got our fingers crossed that Gamba can grab a couple of wins in the last three match days and maybe get themselves up and out of the relegation zone before the end of the season. Up at the other end of the table, fourth from top, is Gamba's city rivals, Cerezo. They, though, had to settle for a point after a draw themselves at home on Saturday afternoon. This was against relegation dogfight combatant Shonan, And well, this was a battle of a player and a team who like leaving things very, very late. I think we can say that for definite. Cerezo finally took the lead in this game in the 92nd minute through late show specialist Jean Patrick. He scored from the spot after Mutsuki Kato was fouled by Shuto Yamamoto in the box. This was Jean Patrick's fifth league goal of the season for Cerezo, and all of them have come in the 77th minute of games or later. And indeed, I think the four of them had come in second half stoppage time. And yes, so he's been the man of the hour late on for Cerezo late on in games. And he thought he'd obviously done the trick again, scoring in the second minute of stoppage time. But there was late drama yet again involving Shonan in the 96th minute. And it was Kato again who headed in a Hiroyuki Abe free kick for an own goal, despite his keeper Kim Jin-hyun's best effort to try and keep it out. A really odd odd way to concede for Cerezo. There were four Cerezo pink shirts in the centre, and not a Shonan player anywhere near the ball. But I guess Kato's striker's instinct kicked in. It was a terrific header, but yeah, unfortunately for him and his side, into his own net. And so for yet another occasion, Shonan have drawn late on, Sam. Of course, they did the trick famously a couple of match days ago against Shimizu. They drew at home against Shonan, Urawa in a game that you said that they probably should have won. But here again, facing leaving Cerezo with nothing, they've rescued a point right at the death, and it's enough to keep them above water and out of the playoff place.
Yeah, and a cynical person would say, after conceding that late goal, Cerezo might look at the time and go, ah, it's not that bad, is it? If Gamboa down there and it's kept Shonan above them. But I'm not suggesting anything at all. But but Shonan, I think, deserved the point. Like, there's just been farcical scenes to get the equaliser. But I thought, on the balance of play, it was a pretty even game. Machino, when he came on, looked very good. He was, his movement off the ball was really nice. He found space in different areas as well, like dropping deep, all going through the channels. Kim had to be at his best for a couple of saves. And likewise, Tani did the same when Cerezo went forward. There wasn't a great deal in it otherwise. And yeah, this goal, I mean, it's hard to really explain it, isn't it? I mean, Kato, I think, is maybe put off, if I'm going to try and bail him out, by Kitano, who makes a half jump in front of him. And then I don't think he quite touches it, but it might just put Kato off. And then, yeah, he buries his header past his own goalkeeper. So, yeah, interesting at the end. But I thought, yeah, a draw I thought was fair. And Shonan, yeah, credit to them in the way that they continue to battle, a bit like Kyoto. They're not going to be an easy game for anyone to play against. So I think that might, at the end of the season, just about be enough to keep their heads above water. But they're dicing with it a little bit, conceding penalties in the manner that they did. Just so sloppy from Yamamoto. He doesn't notice Kato behind him, and it's a really poor foul. So he'll be delighted that Kato has put pity on him and scored at the other end.
Indeed. All right. Well, Johnny, we had a question on Shonan from Steve Fryer. He has, of course, guested on Extra Time this season talking about Omiya Adija. But long-time listeners might remember that Steve is as close as we've ever had to a Shonan correspondent on this podcast, as back when Belmare beat Yokohama F. Marinos in the Levain Cup final. Steve joined us to talk about that game and to celebrate with the Belmare, as he lived down in the Shonan area for 7 years before taking his talents up to Saitama. So Steve's wondering about Belmare. He mentions that they've, yes, been fighting hard, getting some vital late wins. As I should have mentioned, of course, the famous 2-1 win over Kawasaki to complete the double, as well as the draw with Shimizu. And yes, scoring crucial late goals, as they've done here on Saturday. So Steve wonders, do we think they have done enough to avoid the drop? That's the first question. And if they fall into 16th, do you think they have enough to beat or draw one of the likely contenders from the J2 playoffs? Steve says he's concerned and really wants them to stay in J1. And here, so do I, because I want to go and watch them again take on FC Tokyo next year, Steve. But Johnny, about Shonan, I wonder whether they're a cat with nine lives and they might have used up eight and a half of them. But I guess while they're still plucking out points, out of the fire and keeping them their heads above water, then it's enough to keep them, as I said, out of the drop zone. But I wonder when their luck might run out.
I'm kind of on the fence when it comes to Shonan. I think Vissel, Kyoto and Espals, it's by no means going to be a safe ride, but I think they'll all be okay. Shonan are the team outside the bottom three, I think could slip into the bottom three. Mm. I think three of the last four games are away from home. They have, I think, the last 10 games, they've won one and lost three, so they've drawn a lot. So they could continue to draw their way to safety. I think that big game again, Vissel Kobe away. You've got FC Tokyo away this weekend. That's a tough game. Then Tosu at home again is winnable, but and Reysol away. It again comes down to the goal scoring, doesn't it? Only 24 goals this season. It's the same as Avispa. They haven't really scored in this game. They've had to loan in Mutsuki Kato to bury one in the back of the net for them. So, yeah, I honestly, I'm really on the fence. To get to the second point, I think Shonan would be capable of drawing 0-0 with the team I think will come up in the playoffs, Oita. And I have to say, like, while I agree with you, it's completely farcical for the J1 team to be at home and not have to win. That whole thing kind of spreads down to J2 as well. So I think they need to fix the whole system. So I have less sympathy if it's a team that finished fifth or sixth in J2 rather than if it's third place and they're clearly the best of the playoff teams. But yeah, I think Shonan are a plucky team. I'd actually back most of these teams in J1 to at least draw at home in a playoff. It's all weighted in their favour. Whether they'll be in it, I think it's a toss of a coin at the minute for me, to be honest. Are you any more confident one way or the other, Sam?
I'm never really confident on Shonan, I don't think. But the games are... you'd probably take those games if you were Shonan. FC Tokyo have probably got nothing to play for. Tosu haven't got anything. Kashiwa, not really either. They're all games where I think they could grab a victory, and it might only take one victory to make them safe, just because it's a Avispa behind them and Gamba who've not really looked like stringing anything together. So, yeah, I'm slightly on the fence, but I think Shonan will just about have enough of it. I mean, I've tried to avoid this for most of the season, but I think as I sit here now, and I'll probably change my mind next week or tomorrow, but I think that current bottom three is the bottom three that I think will be going down or in that order. I don't know if who's 16th, 17th or even 18th, because I'm not ruling Jubilee out, because their fixture list is the best one on paper. And they've got those games in hand as well. So I'm not ruling them out. And they've come back from the death so many times this season. It'd be stupid to. But yeah, as for Shonan, I think the fixtures are just kind enough that they'll just squeak out enough points.
Yeah, it's it's obviously so tight to call. Now that we've established that Sapporo have worked their way up to, on the coattails of mid-table mediocrity, in inverted commas, they're out of the relegation dogfight. So from 12th Vissel Kobe down to the bottom club, Iwata, it is, it's a quagmire, but there will obviously be three teams very, very disappointed at the end of the season. And, one, we're still with a lifeline of having to contest the playoff. But, so from 12th, Kobe down. Kobe have 34 points. 13th placed Kyoto have 33. Shimizu have 32, as do Shonan. And, tellingly, as some of the guys have mentioned, all those four teams have played 30 games. So they have one in hand on Fukuoka and Gamba below them. Fukuoka are 16th on 31 points and Gamba 17th on 30. Then still bottom, of course, are Iwata, who didn't play over the weekend. They have 24 points but have only played 29 games. So they have two games in hand on the two other relegation zone occupants, Gamba and Fukuoka, and a game in hand on the four teams currently outside the drop zone. So, yeah, so much drama still to come. And, yeah, we can't wait to watch it all unfold. Though, yeah, supporters of these teams obviously will be watching through their fingers at times, I'm sure. So, well done again to Sean Hunt for battling back late on. And, yeah, Steve, as I said, I've got my fingers crossed that they can stay up as well, Belmare and still be playing in J1 in 2023. So one more game to go then, and we can finish this off very quickly. It was up at the Kashima Soccer Stadium, and basically it was the only game in the match day that didn't have any impact at all on the title race, the battle for the ACL spots, or the relegation dogfight. And Kashima Antlers hosted FC Tokyo, and the visitors, the Gasmen, returned back to the capital with all 3 points, thanks to Shuto Abe's tremendous volley from 25 yards in the 84th minute that went in off the glove of Antlers keeper Tomoki Hayakawa. So, yeah, one that Hayakawa will not like to see back. And, yeah, getting a hand to it, he probably should have saved it, but still a terrific technique on Abe's hit. And, yeah, terrific goal, but slightly frustrating for me as he hasn't really kicked on, has he, Abe, in the last couple of seasons to build on his first full season in the Tokyo first team. And obviously, Kuryu Matsuki has stolen all of the headlines in central midfield for FC Tokyo this season, until, of course, Koki Sukugawa came on the scene and won all of our hearts. But, yeah, Abe, a reminder of what he's capable of. And, well, I don't know, gents, do either of you want to offer an opinion on this game or on how either of these teams are travelling, or should we just wrap things up from here? An open-ended question that a podcast host knows he shouldn't really be asking. But, yeah, are you guys happy with my brief summary of events up in Kashima?
I think the last time I was on with Sam, we were talking about Kashima against Shonan, and basically I just make similar points against Kashima, and adding in that I can't believe they're still fifth in the league. I have no idea. It seems to be out of form for so long. I don't know how they're still fifth, but I think there's going to be big changes there in the winter. But what about Sam? Did you have anything to add?
I just have Kashima as probably one of the negative surprises, given how they started the season and how everyone expected them to be playing in this swashbuckling team. So sort of just fizzle out in the manner that they have has just been quite extraordinary. I know they lost Wada, but it doesn't really explain everything that's gone so wrong at Kashima. So, yeah, they're an interesting one for this off-season, because I'm quite sure that Daikiro Amasa is not going to be in a job at the start of next season. So where do they go from here? And, yeah, FC Tokyo... Yeah, it was a good goal from Abe, fantastic goal. But, yeah, I think it's been a reasonable season for them in terms of building Albert Pucci's way of playing. And, yeah, can he build on that and challenge for the ACL next season? I think they're two teams that are kind of more interesting in the off-season than maybe at this point of this season.
Yeah, fair enough. So, yeah, they're now together in the table. As Johnny says, somehow Antlers are still fifth, and Tokyo rose above Kashiwa and into sixth with their victory, and indeed with a game in hand on Antlers. So, yeah, we'll leave it there then. But something I should have done before we left the relegation dogfight, Johnny, and I fully accept you might want to excuse yourself from doing this, but, yeah, Sam's basically nailed his colours to his mask there and says he would be predicting the current bottom three to go down in some order. As I say, you're more than welcome to excuse yourself from offering up an opinion on who you think is going to go down or finish between 16th and 18th. But did you want to offer that up? This might be your last appearance of the season proper. So I guess it's your last chance to stick your neck out if you choose to do so.
I am aware that I've been looking at a league table showing Fukuoka 16th, Gamba 17th, Niwata 18th for the last hour and a half, which obviously makes me think that's how it's going to finish. I think I would say... Yeah, as positive as Sam was, I don't see Jubilo going on a random winning spree of like three or four of the last five games. I think Jubilo will finish 18th and Fukuoka and Gamba will finish in some order, 16th or 17th. And Shonan are the only team outside of the current bottom three that I think might end up in the bottom three. I think Shimizu Kyoto and Kobe will all be okay. So at the moment, yeah, I'd say Fukuoka, Osaka, Iwata. Iwata bottom with Fukuoka and Gamba in some sort of order. Are you gonna join the bandwagon, Ben?
I suppose you two guys have done it. I better do it as well. Completely throwing darts here, but looking at where it sits at the moment, again, I shouldn't really be throwing stones at Fukuoka as they've done the double over us again this season at FC Tokyo, but Fukuoka, I think we'll go down automatically with Iwata, and then. I don't know how they're going to do it, Johnny, but a great escape for Gumba. Well, I could just about see it. And this might stun you both, but when we spoke of Kobe's horrendous fixture list that they've still got to play, I know they've just won three on the spin. They're unbeaten in four. But as we've seen with the other clubs going up, and slowly sinking back down, I have a suspicion that Kobe might have won their last game of the season on Saturday, and they might end up ending back down in 16th with Fukuoka 17th and Iwata, unfortunately, bottom, although they've been great scrappers all season, of course. But who knows? None of us do, but that's our best guesses with most teams having three or four games to play in the season, and of course Iwata five. All right then, so let's wrap things up then with any other questions that we haven't gotten to, and you guys think we should address before the end of the episode. We could throw a couple more teams in for Brian Smith's question of positive or negative biggest surprises of the season to this point. I guess for me, the teams that have been positive surprises, Hiroshima, Kashiwa and Sagan, I'm sure they'd be popular picks amongst the three of us. And in terms of negative or disappointing teams thus far, then Reds, Kobe and Gumba have to be my podium finishers for that honor or dishonor. I don't know, whichever you want to call it. But Johnny, if I go back to you then, do you want to give us a couple more teams or indeed players if more have come to you in the meantime?
I think you've nailed it pretty well on the head. The obvious ones, to go slightly less obvious, I had Marinos finishing fifth this season, and I think in my pre-season preview I said that the squad on paper looked weaker than last year. Mm-hmm. But obviously, Frontale have slipped away, and you've got teams like Hiroshima and Cerezo who are bottom half last year are up there. Kashima have slipped away. I think Marinos to an extent have surprised the fact that the top scorers in the league have the best defence, that they're currently leading by 8 points with four games to go. I did not have that before the season started. And then maybe to throw in a slight negative, Nagoya, they finished third and fifth the last 2 years. The way, I said, hot knife through butter against Marinos' attack against their defence, against Gamba as well. They conceded two goals and could easily have conceded a few more. Just with the same players, essentially, or even bringing in good young players like Fuji or Leo Silva's come in, they've just kind of fallen away defensively, and none of the signings have worked, and they brought in Nagaki, couldn't get a game at Shonan, was playing last week, and Uchida's just a sort of average player on loan from FC Tokyo, and Shigehiro playing as a attacker. And we've no idea what's happening with Sverchok, whether he comes back in and they can make a couple of signings, potentially a manager change and turn it around next year. But it's just all been very, very meh. They're fine relegation wise, but just, if you're a Nagoya fan, 26 goals in 31 games, only conceded 33. Not an awful lot to get excited about. They've changed manager. They've become a bit looser at the back, and they've gone backwards. It's not been a great year, I think. Yeah, what about Sam? Have you got any other kind of obvious ones or maybe surprising positives or negatives?
Well, I will say, don't take this as me just being completely petty because you've stolen my answer again on both accounts. But I'm going to go for my positive. I'll take Cerezo Osaka because I think, given the injuries that they have dealt with all season, for them to have been so consistent, and you take out Kiyotake, the creative hub in that team, or Harakawa, Taggart has been unfit for most of the season. I think for them to continue their levels and to be top four this season, I think has been magnificent. The way that they have managed to integrate J2 signings, I know you're a big proponent of the way that they have used the J2 market. I mean, they've been fantastic there. They've operated to a higher level than I thought at the start of this season. And my negative, I'm sorry, Johnny, but it has to be Gamba Osaka, because that squad shouldn't be in the relegation zone. Yeah, they've been struggling maybe for a little bit more last season, but they've still got so many good players. They shouldn't be in that relegation place. They've got so many players that are just underperforming and have been consistently underperforming. And yeah, I think you said they'd be a non-JPRO team. I had them kind of mid-table. I didn't necessarily think they were going to pull up trees and qualify for the ACL or anything like that, but this season has been particularly negative, and I'm sorry to have got in on you. I'm just being petty because, yeah, you took my answer.
If I could just branch out from your Serizo answer, because you mentioned J2 and a lot of the players, like, for example, Maikum or Nakahara Wejo, were highly rated. Two players they actually signed before the start of last season from Jeff, Toriyumi and Tamida, really they have no right to be starting in a team that's challenging for the ACL, but you know, fair play to Kogiku, he's got the best out of them. And you know, you mentioned about Sagan Tosu might have a good team of like players that used to play for them. Jeff as well, with like Horigome. There's all these players who just did nothing at Jeff in mid-table J2 and suddenly starting in the top half of J1. So yeah, I think that those two as regular starters would have to go down as a big surprise too.
Yeah, indeed. Well done, guys. Yeah, I mean, between the three of us, we've just literally named half of the league. So, yeah, I hope you're satisfied with that, Brian. Certainly a number of teams, both positive and negative surprises through, pretty much the entire season, of course. And, there was one more question we might want to touch on before we wrap things up by looking at the Match Day 32 fixture list. And, Johnny, it's from Victor, and it's specifically for you. We've all nailed our colours to the mast here and said who we think are going to go down at the end of the season or finish in the playoff place. So the last of Victor's questions, and I have to thank you very much, Victor, for doing a lot of the heavy lifting on this episode for us this week, is which J1 team battling against relegation do you think has the most chance of being a threat in J2 next season? So, yeah, if we've written two or three teams off, which of them do you think is the best equipped to, bounce straight back?
If I give a slightly cop-out answer, I think all of them will be dangerous in J2, because if you look at last season of the four teams that went down, Tokushima were the only team that really threatened to stay up. Yet all four of those teams are in the top eight of J2 this season. Where Iwata, who won J2, and them in Kyoto were miles clear of the rest last year, they're bottom. I think we've reached a stage whereby the top 14 or 15 teams in J1 are clearly good J1 teams. It used to be said, I think there was like bottom of J1 and the top of J2 were quite similar. I think some teams have kind of pulled away in J1. I don't know if maybe the COVID pandemic and finances have played a role in that. I know it seems like less players are getting loaned out from J1 to J2 with the COVID clusters. Teams are kind of hoarding players a bit more. So Gamba would not be as strong as they were in 2013, where, I mean, I didn't really follow J League back in 2012, but it seemed like they made a horrendous managerial appointment. But by the second half of the season, they were actually playing like a top half team and they just couldn't pull it round in time. So they just blitzed the opposition in J2. I think, though, players have just signed like Musashi Suzuki or Juan Alano Meshino in J2, they would do a lot of damage. Likewise, Fukuoka were very good the last time they were there. If they kept players like Yamagishi, if Lukian could somehow regain his form, Douglas Grawley, Nara Mia, players like that, Mai, if they didn't lose too many, that they would be a very tough opponent. And Jubilo are basically the same team that got relegated from J1 before, promoted back up and looked like getting relegated again. So I think, realistically, any of those teams, if it's only two that go down, other J2 teams are going to have to do well to get into the automatic promotion places. I see any of those teams in the bottom four or five being quite well equipped to come back up from J2, to be honest. And also, I hear Victor is coming over to Japan quite soon, and I might be meeting up with him. So I look forward to that. And thank you again for your question, Victor.
Yeah, terrific stuff. We'll give him a fist bump for me and Sam, Johnny. That's terrific. And yeah, we appreciate his questions for this week's episode. All right then, Sam. So you said Johnny's stolen your answer a couple of times throughout this episode. So I'll let you go first. Match day 32 takes place this Saturday. All nine games will be played. Six of them kick off at 2 p.m. Then we have two at 3 o'clock and just the one at 4 p.m. So what is Sam's pick of the weekend?
Sam's pick of the weekend.
as much as I want it to be the start of the major Jubilo Iwata revival at Kashima, I'm going to go with Kobe versus Hiroshima. I think this is huge. Like, obviously, Hiroshima, I think second place is still a real battle they are going to have to deal with. They're a real test for Kobe because, yes, they've been on this pretty nice run of results, Kobe, but not necessarily against a great team in that, and not necessarily against teams that were too highly motivated prior to the Avispa game. So this is a real test for them. If they go off to a loss to Hiroshima, then yeah, the rest of the games, they look really difficult, and they're right back in that relegation battle. So yeah, it's difficult for me to look past this game, although yeah, I so want Jubilo to win just to, as a neutral.
All right then, so Kobe Hiroshima is off the board. What is Johnny's pick of the weekend? Johnny's
pick of the weekend.
I think Sam has been very kind because he's left Marinos Gamba to me, and obviously Marinos fans will know that if they win and Frontale lose, then it's party time on Saturday, and they'll also know that you know, Gamba have only lost one of the last seven league visits to Marinos, and that was the time they won the league last time in 2019. So a big game for both teams. I'm sure it might. I'm not sure how many they'll get, 60,000, or if everyone's there expecting a party. For Gamba, I think the best thing that can happen is a couple of early Frontale goals that sort of seeps around the stadium where there's no party today. Kill the atmosphere stone dead, I think, is their best hope. That's definitely my pick of the weekend. With I'd also add in maybe a bit of a surprise, Sanga against Nagoya, because I think of all the teams, you know, Sam's mentioned Visa have a difficult game. I've mentioned Gamba have a difficult game. I think of all those teams in that bottom six or seven, Kyoto at home to Nagoya, who've just been whipped by Marinos 4-0, that's the best chance of 3 points. And I think if Kyoto get 3 points and results go their way, I think they are just about safe. So that it might not be the best game of football you'll ever see, but I think that could be have a massive bearing in the bottom of the league. I mean, do you have any other games you think we should keep an eye on, Ben?
Yeah, Kawasaki Shimizu looks pretty interesting at either end of the table. Yeah, Frontale, I mean, their title hopes are gone, of course. But yes, as we've said, Hiroshima could still nudge them out of second. And yeah, that could spell the end of them qualifying for the ACL if other things go against them. So yeah, they'll be desperate to bounce back after the late disappointment up in Sapporo. And yeah, Shimizu obviously haven't played for quite a while now after the postponement last weekend. And yeah, they're always an entertaining team to watch, at least if they haven't taken the lead early in games and frozen for the remainder of it. So we'll wait and see what happens at Todoroki. Before that, though, of course, we do have the Emperor's Cup semi-finals coming up on Wednesday. Kofu versus Kashima and Kyoto versus Hiroshima for the right to battle out the final on Sunday, October the 16th. So yeah, they should be two interesting semi-finals, no question. Of course, J2 interest with the Kofu involved. And we'll wait and see how those two semifinals pan out before the weekend's match day 32. All right, well, so we'll leave it there. Gentlemen, it's been an epic, as it usually is when the three of us get together. Johnny, thanks ever so much for joining us again and sharing all of your thoughts on the top flight. It's always terrific for us to have you on. And obviously the questions from the listeners show that they're always happy when you're on the podcast as well. And yeah, we look forward to catching up with you. At the end of the season, when we put together our team of the season. And yeah, as I said, fingers crossed for Gamba in the meantime.
Thanks very much, Ben. I'm raising my bat to the pavilion. We've done 2 hours with only eight games, so it's been quite cathartic for me as usual. And hopefully the next time we talk, Gamba are still a J1 club. Thanks again, and thanks again to everyone for your questions.
All right, yeah, terrific as always from Johnny. Sam, we don't expect anything less, of course. Yeah, great to catch up with you as well. And after such a seismic match day 30 and 31, and looking forward to what's coming up in the week ahead and to rounding it all up with you next week.
Yeah, always great to have Johnny on the pod. I think I should have it written into my contract that questions get asked to me first so he doesn't take all my answers. But really fun episode. And I just want to wish you a very happy birthday for Wednesday. I hope the Emperor's Cup brings you everything you wanted.
Well, thank you very much, mate. That's very nice of you. Obviously, you would like love FC Tokyo to be involved in the Emperor's Cup semi-finals on my birthday, but it wasn't to be. But of course, see, I should also wish you a happy birthday. As we record on Monday night with Johnny, it's clicked over to Tuesday morning. So the 4th of October is your birthday. A very happy birthday to you as well.
Well, thank you very much. What a week for the podcast, isn't it? Two birthdays in one. So, yeah, thank you very much. And, yeah, I'll start celebrating now. I'll go and open a can of something.
Indeed, it's your birthday in Japan. So, yes, crack on, mate. Have a fantastic day. All right, then. Well, that is it for this week's episode of the J-Talk podcast. Sam and I would like to thank Johnny Nicol, of course, very much for his time on this week's episode. We'd like to thank Daniel, Brian, Steve, Gabrielle, Victor, and Ralph for their questions and for getting involved in this week's episode. All of them are patrons of the J-Talk podcast. If you'd like to get involved, please visit patreon.com/JTalkPod. Listeners, we'd like to thank you for listening wherever you are as well. So we'll be back to round up, well, the Emperor's Cup semi-finals and J1 Match Day 32 in next week's episode. Speak to you next week. Bye for now.
The J-Talk podcast. Yes, 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 yes.